fellow geek brethren, you have come to the right place for all of your gaming, gadgets, technology, anime, video games, comic books, and anything else you can think of. It is GeekSpeak here at SpeakGeekSpeak.com. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, live from Brooklyn, New York, Ian Levenstein. Hey there, everybody. My name is Ian Levenstein, and welcome to GeekSpeak here at SpeakGeekSpeak.com. Episode 36 of the GeekSpeak podcast, ready to roll here, and finally getting a hold of a man who I tried to get a hold of about 2 months back, but the equipment was not doing its job then. It certainly is now, and I am, of course, talking about Doug Bratton from Pop Culture Shock Therapy. Doug, how are you?
I'm doing great, Ian. Thanks for having me on your show.
You're quite welcome, man. Now, tell us a little bit about Pop Culture Shock Therapy.
Pop Culture Shock Therapy is a daily gag panel. It started out actually as a web-only comic and now is in several papers, primarily college papers around the country. It would, I guess, for someone who's never read it, I guess the best way to kind of describe it, it would be a little bit like if you took the comic panel The Far Side and the television show The Family Guy and kind of mixed them up. It's a single panel gag, but focuses on pop culture references and things that go on in movies and TV and comics and, you know, everything pop culture.
What would you say was your gateway into the world of comics when you first started out?
Well, really going way back. The first work that I did was at the age of 7 with my brother, starting our own comic book, superhero comic books, which is what got me into cartooning. I was a really big comic book fan at a young age, and we did some really, really horribly awful, but now funny, reading back on them, superhero comic books with such classic characters as Dr. Paranoid and Acro-Man and, you know, all sorts of great stuff. And that was really my entry into the field of cartooning. I grew up in Rockaway, New Jersey, which is actually now where I live with my wife and our son and our dog. And fortunately, as luck would have it, the next town over in Dover is the Joe Kubert School for Comic and Graphic Art. I'm not sure if that's the exact name now, but so at a young age, I started taking some Saturday classes over at the Kubert School, and this was, you know, a good 20 years back, so this was when Joe Kubert would actually teach, you know, some of the Saturday morning classes himself, and that really, really, really sucked me into it. As I got older into high school and really got interested in different areas of writing and graphic art, I started doing more like children's book illustration work and then eventually cartooning, more in the sense of comic strips and comic panels and ultimately gag panels, single panels for magazines and newspapers was what really I took to.
Well, it must have been amazing working with a legend like Joe Kubert.
Yeah, well, I'll say I remember him. I'm sure he wouldn't remember me. Yeah, I was probably about 10 years old, and you know, he has a pretty big, you know, school accredited university or college. Back in the old days, it was out of a kind of a mansion in Dover, and they had kind of a little trailer on the side of it where they teach the classes and. You know, it was really cool. I don't think that at that time, I mean, I knew who Joe Kubert was. I had comic books with his work in it. I did not realize as a 10-year-old what a legend Joe Kubert was and is. So it's kind of funny thinking back on it now with some perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you get to tell everybody, hey, I worked with Joe Kubert when I was 10. What about you?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
That was pretty cool.
that certainly sounds cool. I'd love to have that on my resume. Now, what really interests you about pop culture in the first place? I mean, obviously, you have a large range of pop culture references in your comics, and you started out with comics. What really interested you in doing something as broad as pop culture shock therapy?
Well, you know, when I first started doing panels and comic strips, I guess the first thing that had stuck in my head was if I really want to do this as a career, I have to do it around something that I know and can continue for a long period of time. If you're doing daily work, obviously, if the plan is to be able to do it for 10, 20, you know, 30, however many years, you know, you have to be able to sustain and have something that is broad enough and that you're personally familiar enough with to keep it fresh and interesting, so you're not just rehashing the same gags all the time. And you know, when I started out, my first foray into attempting to be a cartoonist, which was the absolute wrong way to do it, but I think it's a pretty common way, was I create a comic strip idea, and for like 3 months, I'd write a bunch up, draw them up, and then just send them out to syndicates and wait for those form letter rejections to come back. And, you know, it was good experience in just developing my writing and my humor writing and my style and things of that nature. But when I started those, I was always trying to write from personal experience. I was always about, you know, a couple little kids, and, you know, it would invariably end up being somewhat Calvin and Hobbes-ish. And, you know, it was decent for what it was, and I was trying to write from experience. I think as I progressed and matured, I realized that, well, writing from your experience doesn't just have to be, you know, what you've lived. It could be things that interest you and excite you and the things that have influenced you. And while it certainly wasn't planned out from a marketing standpoint in this way, but I think it just kind of naturally evolved. You know, the generation, I'm a Gen X generation guy, and certainly our generation, the millennials, the generation after us, have really grown up in a media saturated society. And I think that, you know, generations before us might have been perhaps influenced more by, you know, politics, things that went on in the world, you know, history, religion, certainly all things that still influence people, you know, in their 30s and their 20s and their teens. But with the bombardment of mass media, you know, we've grown up where, you know, characters like Mickey Mouse and Superman are as recognizable to us as, not, you know, to be blasphemous, but as religious characters and presidents. And I think I just got to a point where, you know, growing up as kind of a movie buff and a TV buff and a comic buff, I just realized that these were things that were interesting and funny to me. And what I remember when I first had the idea that I wanted to do a gag panel and wanted to focus it around pop culture, my first thought was, well, is there enough out there to sustain this? So for a week, I just kind of sat and kept a notebook with me and made a list of any characters or movies or, you know, references that I thought were, you know, enough in the popular culture that at least my target audience and people who were into the same things that I was into would get. And within about a week to 2 weeks, I had somewhere between 500 and 1,000 references written down.
Wow.
And, you know, it just kind of, it was like a, you know, a 2x4 to the back of the head, kind of like, wow, you've wasted a lot of time in front of the TV. But, you know, but in the same breath, you know, it really making me realize how much media has influenced, you know, my life experience and certainly other people my age and certainly younger than me. So, you know, and one thing I did do also was I thought a lot about the comics that I was really into growing up as far as strips and panels that had been successful and of high quality. And the big three that I think anybody in, you know, who grew up in the 80s and early 90s could attest to if they read newspaper comics were Bloom County and Calvin and Hobbes and The Far Side. And those were certainly three of my big influences.
The classics, as it were.
Absolutely. And I looked at them, and all of them, I thought, you know, how they were different from a lot of the other, even some of the really classic, long-standing comics that, even from a historical perspective, that I have a tremendous amount of respect for, but maybe growing up, they really didn't, you know, catch my attention the way these did. I felt that all three of those created very unique worlds that had an ability to just constantly grow and expand. And Calvin and Hobbes did that by the fact that the whole comic is based around the imagination of a child. And, you know, that world can constantly expand to, you know, Calvin living in this fantasy world. And, you know, it just, I think that really kept it fresh. Bloom County, which started off, you know, a lot more kind of Doonesbury-ish, political, you know, eventually grew into this kind of these life of all these different odd characters in a town that tied into politics but tied into the world around them. And, you know, it was just, it constantly grew. It didn't, you know, it didn't get boxed in by a premise of, you know, a soldier waiting to go to war, or, you know, just, you know, a regular everyday family going through their typical lives. And then obviously The Far Side, which really didn't, it had a defined world, but certainly lived outside any constraints of any specific time or characters.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, when thinking about those things, I really feel that was a big part of their success, the ability to expand so they weren't just rehashing, you know, the same gags over and over. And when I realized and I thought about popular culture, besides how much I was into it and how much I just kind of grew up immersed in it, you know, it is something that is truly created on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, and there's always new material. There's always classic things happening, you know, but there's always some new celebrity tabloid thing going on or a new movie coming out. You know, if a year and a half ago, you wouldn't have even thought about Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, you know, having a silent birth, you know, but now that's something that has really permeated into the popular culture, so it gives you something new to latch onto and to poke fun of.
Yeah, sadly, that is part of our culture now, but what are you going to do?
Exactly.
Every now and then the Scientologists catch on, but now, what made you decide to go into the medium of webcomics? I know that you discussed a lot of the you know, comic strips that you read in the newspaper. Was it the fact that it was just so difficult to break into a newspaper medium, or did you feel the web was just more open?
Well, that's a good question. Kind of yes and no. As far as did I feel it was too hard to break into in the newspapers? I think one thing was I got to a point where I was doing freelance work. I was doing some gag panels for different clients. I was starting to do some magazine work at that time, and I felt like, hey, if what you want to be is a cartoonist, then you need to be a cartoonist. And that might sound kind of silly, but, you know, a cartoonist doesn't write for a couple of weeks and then take a month off. And that was kind of the easy out of doing a batch of a comic and sending it off to a syndicate and waiting 3 months. And there is a part of me that felt like, well, if you really want to do this, you should probably make sure that you can do it. You know, I felt comfortable enough with where I was at as far as my writing and all of that went, but you don't know if you can sustain the daily grind and deadlines of this type of field until you actually do it. So for me, the internet really met a couple of needs of mine. One, it met the need to try and get work out on these, you know, daily deadlines. So that was the first part about it. You know, I said, okay, I'm going to stop drawing up a batch of 24 and sending it off. I'm going to make sure I put something out every day. So part of it was a self-discipline thing. And then there was another part of it that I really felt that this was a way to get word of mouth out there, to build up an audience over time. And I found that that happened. And the funny thing about it was, since my original goal was to get the comic into newspapers, the internet really helped do that, because eventually it got exposure. A lot of that came from, you know, because I was doing pop culture references, you know, all of a sudden someone would come across it and send it into, you know, a Superman or a Smallville website or something like that, and it would get posted, and then all of a sudden you get a bunch of hits because the people that are really into Superman now are seeing your work, and so they're checking out your website. So it really helped kind of start to build up, you know, some sort of a fan base and get the work out there to people. And then it became easier to start approaching some of the papers. And, you know, I'm primarily in college newspapers now because I think a lot of the work that I do really is geared towards, you know, that 30-something, 20-something teen age group and kind of hit things that age group is interested in. And really, the internet tied quite well into getting it out to that type of an audience. So,
well, as a 20-something internet dweller, I would certainly agree with you. So,
oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, when I found you at Mocha, I was absolutely drawn to the pop culture aspect because I mean, doing the show that I do, where like I try to put as much you know, of everything geekdom that I can possibly fit into a show at one time. This was like, you know, absolutely eating it up for me. So that was great there. Were you more active in your advertising for Pop Culture Shock Therapy, or did you go more for a viral sort of campaign where one person would find out about it and then spread the word?
It was more, I would say it was more just kind of people finding it and spreading the word. I certainly did some advertising and not, you know, not paying for ad spaces on other sites, but, you know, I would send out information to people that I knew and I had connections with to let them know I was doing this, to encourage them, to let other people know. Certainly nothing organized like, you know, chain emails about this or anything. But there are certain things I did, like with the website. We have a subscription service, which we still have on it. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. And what happens is anybody who wants can go click on the subscribe here. They put in their email address. The comic is emailed to them every day. I think that really helped it grow, because now what would happen is someone would get a comic in their email. Well, if you get something that you find funny in your email, a lot of people, just by the, you know, the nature of the internet culture, which I think annoys most of us, but we all still do it, is you forward it to everybody on your list. So now, you know, now I had comics getting forwarded out to other people. You know, and then I had some help from friends and family who would, if they found a comic that fit something, you know, that they were into, they might contact, you know, a website. For my brother actually was really helpful in getting some of my Superman comics out to some of the really major Superman fan sites, which I know nothing about, but he's been involved with for a long time. And every once in a while, if he found one he liked, he would just email, you know, whoever at that website and say, hey, you know, my brother does this comic. I thought it was funny. It's about Superman. Take a look. And then, you know, they would pick it up and put it on the site. So some of that has just kind of happened naturally, but some of that was through help from friends, family in getting the word out.
Around how quickly did the word get spread out? I mean, when did you go from around 5 or 10 people to, you know, the millions or whatever amount that you have going to your site daily?
That's a good question, and it's hard for me to answer because I have a web guy who does all that for me. I'm becoming more computer literate. Obviously, I do some of my work on my comic on the computer, and I certainly use it as an instrument, but I started out being very much computer illiterate, you know, as little as 5, 6 years ago, right before I was starting the comic.
Yeah.
You know, the first time, I would say it probably took about 6 months to a year before I started noticing that things were happening that maybe I didn't directly start. You know, like I'd find out a comic of mine was posted on a website and I didn't know how it got there, which was fine. And I wanted that. I'm not a big, like, oh, you're stealing my copyrighted work. I put my website on all my work. You know, it has the copyright logo and all that. I want it out there. Anybody who wants to, you know, take a comic and stick it on their website, that's just great advertising for me. But it took about that length of time, you know, and then I'd start getting like all of a sudden I'd have a subscriber from, you know, Australia, or, you know, I remember hearing from someone from a country in the Middle East that I'd never heard of before, you know, like things like that started happening, where it was clear to me that, okay, it's, you know, it's not just, you know, my friends in and around where I live. It's actually getting out there across the country and, you know, really out to the world.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Oh, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, I mean, the first time that I got an email or even a message from somebody that didn't live in like my hometown, it was a shock to me. And then when I started finding out that there were, you know, some people listening, oh, you know, as far as Ireland or the UK, I'm like, holy crap, this internet is a large place.
It is. It's such a great resource for anybody who is creative and in whatever field wants to get their work out. It allows you, especially most of us and what we're doing, we do have a limited target audience. And if our limited target audience is geographically isolated to 20 miles around us, well, then, you know what, I might have 20, 40, 50 people reading my comic. Whereas, you know, if it's out there everywhere, you can really exponentially grow that audience.
Definitely, without a doubt. Around how often do you get user feedback in your email? I mean, do you get users maybe giving you suggestions on some realms of pop culture that you might not have touched on before? Or is it more, thank you for doing this, I'm really happy to listen to it?
You know, it's funny. There are a few people that I've gotten to the point where I'll just email back and forth with a lot. There are certain comics that I know when I put it out that I know I'll get an email from, you know, this person or that person, just from getting those emails. It's not like an overwhelming amount. I certainly, at this point, am easily capable of answering every email that I get from a reader. You know, I've never been bombarded with, you know, like 100 emails in a day or anything like that. Much, much, much less than that. What I find is I'll usually get comments on comics that just people really like and want to just reply and say, like, oh, this one was really funny, or, oh, you might want to put this one in your next book, things like that. Every once in a while, there are certain people that, because we've developed kind of a rapport back and forth with, where I'll get suggestions. And actually, there's another cartoonist who I've become friends with through doing the comic, who, you know, I kick myself for not saving all of our emails, because we could probably put out a really cool book on, like, the mind of cartoonists. And he's almost become like a sounding board to me. I'll give him a plug here. His name is Kurt Marquardt, and I believe his website is kurtmarquardt.com. And, you know, it's just, we've gotten to the point where, you know, he can email me and say, hey, you know what, I like the way you did this in this comic, or, hey, you know, I think if you would have done this, it might have even been funnier.
Yeah.
And the thing that is just great about it, it's almost like having an unpaid editor, is he's right like 99% of the time, and it drives me crazy, because I'm like, damn, why didn't I think of that before I did it, you know? But, you know, it's cool. And things like that happen. You certainly, you know, you just kind of get to know. There are people who will one-shot email me, you know, like, hey, I like this comic, or, you know, hey, I think you stink, and you occasionally get hate mail. Very rarely, I will say. That's nice. I certainly get a lot more positive feedback than negative. But over time, there are a number of individuals that, you know, I recognize when I get an email. It seems like people are more apt, if they email you once and they see you respond back and, you know, you're not being jerky or whatever, that they, I guess they feel more comfortable emailing in more frequently. And I love that. I mean, to me, one of the trickiest things about being a cartoonist as compared to almost any other art field, and actually you could probably relate to this being, you know, on the radio, and especially if it's not always live and you're not getting caller feedback, is you're putting out something, especially that ends up being humor-based, and you never see a reaction from your audience.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a stand-up comedian, you get up there and you make your jokes, and if they bomb, they bomb. You say, okay, this isn't working. Let me change it up. If you kill and everybody in the audience is laughing hysterically, you know you got something going. As a cartoonist, whether you're, you know, in print, online, whatever, you never see that reaction. And the only way you can gauge that is if someone takes the time to email you or come up to you at, you know, a comic festival that you're exhibiting at and tell you, hey, I really like your work, or, you know, I think your work really sucks. I mean, that's the extent of the feedback that you can get. So,
well, you know, the negative feedback is sometimes as positive as the positive feedback. You know, I mean, you see what you're doing wrong, or you see, you know what, it keeps you modest, as it were. You know,
yeah,
it doesn't give you a big head.
It's you know, it's true, because I think that I've never come across any artist or cartoonist or person in any sort of creative medium that didn't have people who didn't like their work or who hated their work or didn't get their work. And it's almost, to me, it's kind of like earning your stripes. It means that your work is getting out there so much that there are people that it's getting to who don't like it and aren't into it and aren't your audience. And, you know, I mean, one of my favorite or a couple of my favorite books, but one that's very affordable. I was going to say the Complete Far Side Collection. You know, that's a lot. But a great book was the 10-year retrospective or 10-year anniversary book on the Far Side, called The Prehistory of the Far Side. And he puts in some of the, like, crazy hate mail that he got. And it's so funny to me because, I mean, first of all, just I can't imagine anybody not liking Larson's work because it's brilliant. But, you know, it also makes you feel like, okay, it's okay if you Google your comic and you see a bunch of positive posts, but then you see one where this person writes, oh, I hate this comic, or, you know, whatever. That's part of it. You know, if you don't have thick enough skin to take people not liking your work, then, you know, don't get it. Don't bother putting it out there, because it's going to happen. There are going to be people who don't like what you do. There are people who didn't like Calvin and Hobbes, Far Side, whatever, they're not going to like what you're doing, you know. So you just, that's just part of the game.
And that's also part of the internet also, because for as many positive people there are on the internet, there's going to be like 10 people that, you know, say, oh, it's been done before. Oh, I've seen this before somewhere else. I don't need to see this here, you know.
Well, it is funny. You can tell when someone's like, I remember the first kind of a negative thing that I came across was one time did like a kind of a caption contest for my comic, and I got this like really vicious. I'd never, you know, everything I'd been sent or emailed or even from Googling the comic to see where it was being posted had always been really positive. And I got this like vicious kind of like lashing out, like just using language that I'm not going to use on your radio program. And I was like, wow. And then kind of the last line of it was something like, you know, your comic is taking up space in my college's paper that, you know, could be used for, you know, more talented artists like myself. And it was kind of like, oh, okay. You know, I'm really ticking somebody off because I'm taking their space.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's not just to say, oh, well, it's sour grapes. Hey, you know what? My comic's not for everybody. You know, nobody's comic is for everybody. And this person might validly not have liked it. And I think the one thing that I realized in doing this in cartooning is I have a lot of respect for cartoonists whose work I'm not even particularly a fan of, just because I realized that, hey, they've worked really hard to get where they are, to build up an audience, and just to meet the deadlines, especially cartoonists that write and draw their own work, you know, who aren't hiring, you know, teams of writers, which there are very few who ever get to that point where they could even afford to do that. But even comics that I don't particularly like or find funny, I realize that part of that is just I'm not their target audience. You know, if they're doing a comic that is supposed to be funny for like 50-year-old women, well, I'm not a 50-year-old woman. So, you know, I'm not going to go out and trash it and say, oh, this comic is horrible. It's not for me, you know.
Yeah.
And, And certainly my comic isn't for everybody either. So.
It definitely, yeah. I mean, and also, one of the good things about a podcast is that you don't need to worry about the FCC getting after you if you curse. So,
okay, so I can start dropping the F-bomb now.
Yeah, well, not too often, but if it slips every...
I'm kidding.
I know. If it slips every now and then...
I keep it clean.
Yeah, I try my best to keep it clean, too, but sometimes when I go off on a rant before I know it, bada bing, bada boom. But
there you go.
Definitely. Now, you mentioned the college campuses. Did they approach you, or did you approach them?
You know, the first one was kind of a mix of the two, actually. The guy, my web guy, who is just really phenomenal, give him a plug, Dan Andrulli, my buddy Dan, shout out. He was a graduate of Rutgers University. And when he was doing the website and going through the comics, he was like, you know, the Rutgers Targum, which is a daily, there aren't a lot of college dailies. Most of them are weeklies, but Rutgers happened to be a daily one. He said, they're always looking for new work. I think yours, you know, I think it's really funny. I think that a lot of other college students would, and I think it's, you know, would stand up very well to what's currently in there. So he kind of passed it along to, you know, people he knew on campus, and it eventually got in the hands of an editor at the newspaper, and, you know, I sent them some more information, didn't hear from them for a while, so I thought it was a dead issue, and kind of out of the blue in the fall, right before school started, I got a call from the new editor, and she had, I guess, come across it from the person before her, and she really liked it, and, you know, we set up a meeting, you know, I kind of got a sense of what they needed from me and how that would work, and, you know, negotiated pricing, which was really awkward for someone who, you know, didn't really have much to gauge what newspapers pay and what's appropriate and what's not and what you can ask for and all of that. So that was kind of a fun learning experience. But that was kind of the genesis of Pop Culture Shock Therapy in the Rutgers Daily Targum, which was the first paper to ever have Pop Culture Shock Therapy, and now it's been in for 3 years, and this will be the fourth one coming up.
Wow. Well, it's like whatever way you can get yourself out there, it's definitely a good thing. So, especially to college kids, because they're a nice medium to get a hold of.
Yeah, definitely a great audience. I think very receptive to it. You know, certainly what I focus on is right up their alley, and I think they also, you know, certainly not lumping everybody under the same umbrella, but the type of humor and the type of sense of humor is going to relate more to your average college student than your average, say, grandparent.
Now, you mentioned pricing for the newspapers. Around how often do you get readers of the web version of your comic donating, as it were, to the cause? Giving you a nice friendly wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more, and maybe giving you a couple bucks here and there.
You know what? I've never solicited a donation through the website, and maybe that's something I need to look into. I guess I view it as, I like the internet as a free medium. I think that, you know, certainly, hey, you know, anybody out there wants to send me a check, I'll gladly take it. I view it more as my way of getting my work out to new audiences, building my resume, and I think that for me anyway, that's worked well. I know there are people who found ways to charge and make money off of that. I certainly do make money through the website from selling my books. And certainly it's a tremendous advertising tool for me when I do approach new newspapers, which I do actively solicit newspapers now. So to be able to refer them to the website, to be able to sell books through the website, that's the way that I make money from the website. And I certainly think that it's helped just in general. I think like a lot of fields, cartooning, you really, to break into new markets and new audiences, you have to, and you know, your work stands for itself, but at the same time, reputation is important.
Sure, definitely.
And I think no one wants to, you know, if someone sends them a batch of 24 of the funniest comics they've ever read, but there's they don't know the person. There's the danger of, hey, we might start running this in our paper, and like 2 months from now, this person's going to drop off the face of the earth. We're never going to hear from them, you know, and that creates stress and havoc on an editor. So I think that building up your reputation as, you know, someone who has met your deadlines for years, has consistently put out your work, has gotten it to people on time, has gotten a certain quality of work out there, that builds your reputation in the field, and then people are more willing to take a chance on you. Editors are more willing to buy your work. Certainly getting into some of the bigger magazines that I've gotten into in the last couple of years, I think has a lot to do with the success of the comic. I do pretty regular work now for Nickelodeon magazine with another cartoonist, Bill Alger. I pretty much write and do layouts, and he has a really great kind of a kid-friendly Cartoon Network style that that he does the finished work on. And I also, more recently in the past several months, have started doing some work for Mad Magazine. And there's no doubt that having the Daily Comic and the reputation that has built has helped make those inroads for those venues.
Now, you mentioned the books, and you also mentioned to me that the second book is going to be coming out soon.
Yeah.
Around what point did you decide to go into the realm of books, and how have they been selling so far?
You know, it's funny. One of my first goals that I set, I'm very goal-oriented, I think, for anybody in any field, whether it's creative or otherwise. If you don't have goals or things you're shooting for, you just kind of wander aimlessly, and you know, you do it when you get around to it. And I think it's a lot easier to achieve success in whatever field you're in if you do have a focus and a drive, and there are goals that you're shooting for. And one of my very first goals when I started Pop Culture Shock Therapy was I really wanted to put out a compilation book. That was something that was, you know, important to me. You know, one of my first goals, I said, hey, I want to do this long enough to put out a book of that collects some of my work. So really, that first goal became, well, I want to have 200 comics so I can put a book out, which is funny because I didn't put out my first book till probably after two and a half years of doing the comics. So by the time I had the book out, you know, I probably had a good 600 comics and got to kind of choose and put together kind of a best of. It's gone really well. I think that it's sold quite well. My first book, I came out with it right at Mocha Art Festival last year. And for any of your listeners who don't know what Mocha is, I'll give it a plug. Mocha stands for the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art in Manhattan. This is the fifth year they're doing an annual festival. It's not like your traditional Comic-Con in the sense that it's not a bunch of like comic book dealers there. It's all artists, all comic and cartoon artists from really a huge broad spectrum. You have independent mini comic artists up to like big time syndicated cartoonists and famous comic book artists. So it really, there's really a broad spectrum of cartoonists that exhibit at Mocha. And for people that are interested in it, it is in Manhattan at the Puck Building, I believe.
Yeah.
June 10th and 11th. And the website for people who are interested in going is mocany.org. That's mocany.org. Give them a little plug. Last year was the first year I made sure I got kind of my advanced copies of my book back in time for Mocha. And it was really fantastic. I mean, besides generating, you know, some good sales, it's just another great way to get your work out. One of the reasons that I was interested in doing compilation books is when I would read comics in the newspaper, you know, there are some that I would find funny here and there. The ones that I got really sucked into and addicted to were ones that I got compilation books for, or someone had read a compilation book and told me about, because I do think there's, you know, there's some humor in reading one really funny comic, but there's nothing like getting a true sense of what someone's work is like than by getting a book in print, good quality, seeing it not shrunk down or not pixelated online, and getting to read like 200 of their comics and just really get a sense of where their humor and their style is at. And, you know, that was always something that I really wanted to do. And I think from the feedback I've gotten since Mocha and some of the connections that I made through that and how it's helped me break into some new markets, it's really been positive. And actually, I will be at Mocha, the one that I plugged, the art festival, June 10th and 11th. I'll be there with the advanced copies of my second book, which is called Get Rich or Die Smile. And it's basically the cover of it is a kind of like the yellow smiley face guy, but he has the body sort of Mickey Mouse, and he's strapped into an electric chair. So you can't miss it. Actually, if you come, you might have to wander around through the crowds for quite some time. There are a ton of exhibitors, but if you're diligent and you look hard enough, you'll definitely find me there, and I'll have those advanced copies of the book. So.
And you might even find me there, because I will definitely be there at least one of those days, because I enjoy that festival a lot. I've gone the past 2 years, and it's a great way to discover a lot of independent artists you might not have found otherwise.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's such a great venue for both sides of the field. I think for just fans that are interested in getting to know new work and realizing that some of the filters out there, you know, cut out a lot of really good work that might never get to them, Mocha is a great place to go around and, you know, meet the artists and see the work. And, you know, it's really cool because most of the artists there will, you know, they'll talk to you and they'll sign and they'll sketch for you. And to me, that's also just a really cool thing from both ends. From being an artist, it's fun to get to meet and interact and see fans' responses. And at the same time, I think as a fan, it's cool. I'll occasionally get to sneak away from the table. And to me, just the value of being able to go and meet an artist that I like their work and, you know, pay $10 or $15 for a book and have them sketch it and sign it for me, it's just so much cooler than, you know, just ordering it online or something. So,
definitely. And I mean, I know that Mocha is how I found out about you in the first place. And, I mean, that's also where I managed to get because of that, winning that raffle and getting that original sell of the Aquaman comic. Oh, my God. I want to thank you so much for that, because that is just a brilliant piece of artwork. And, I mean, and also the fact remains that I got on your mailing list that way, and that's how I read your comic regularly. So
yeah, and actually, just to plug that for your audience, you know, again, I think this is one of the cool things about Mocha Art Festival and having the artists actually there and getting to meet people and, you know, getting to make new fans. One of the things that I always try and do is give some benefit to whoever's coming by and seeing my table and seeing my work. I sell my books there. They're like $12 each or something. I sell them. They're less than cover price at the festival. You know, I sign and sketch for everybody. And then anybody who buys a book or anybody who signs up, again, for the free mailing list, so you don't even have to spend money if you don't want, I do like a drawing each day there, and I'll give out an original. And that's pretty much the only time I do that, because I do sell originals just, you know, through fans, and I had an exhibit in Manhattan this year, so I give some out, not frequently. Mocha is one place that I find it's a cool venue, and you know, I've gotten such a positive response from doing it that each year I'll bring a couple originals and have a drawing at the end of the day, and someone walks away with an original. So if you're a fan of the comic, that's always a really cool thing to walk away with. If you're pulled from the hat.
Do you do any of the major conventions or just things like Mocha?
Primarily Mocha, although I am planning on, a year in advance, I'm planning on going out to San Diego Comic-Con next year.
Okay.
And possibly, I went to the New York Comic-Con this year, but not as an exhibitor. I wanted to check out Artist Alley. For any of your listeners who went this year, it was a really cool event that they packed into, unfortunately,
yeah,
a way too small
venue. I was there and waded through the crowds, and luckily I had a 3-day pass, or else I would have been shut out. So,
yeah, I mean, I got to go in as a professional and barely made it in, and you know, and certainly not knocking it, because I think they did a really good job for the first year. I think they gravely underestimated the crowds that they would have. And it's at the Javits Center, but they use like one-third or one-fourth of it.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that's being corrected. I certainly filled out my online survey of it. Early word is that they are going to correct that and make it a much bigger venue. I'm waiting to see if that does happen. I do plan on exhibiting there next year, but again, I want to make sure that, you know, it's a properly run venue before I, you know, pay my money to get a table there.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with that. I mean, from what preliminary reports have showed, I think they're actually going to be moving the date already so that they'll be able to get more of the hall, because I think there was like a cosmetics fair there the same day, and it was very awkward seeing, you know, like cosplayers and then people trying to put perfume on you. But
You know, it was, I think there was I walked by the cosmetics people. I think there was like Jeopardy tryouts.
There were Jeopardy
tryouts that day.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, people walking around in like Stormtrooper outfits and Batman costumes. And it was kind of like, wait a minute, what's going on?
Well, you know what? It's a meeting of pop culture, just right up your alley.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the New York Comic Con, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to knock it off. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
It was a really great event. It was just in a venue that was too small. The day I went on Saturday, I think there were 8,000 people that were turned away from admission into the Comic-Con just because of the space that was allotted. So, again, you know, I'm lobbying, I'm sure you are, and I'm sure everybody else who attended, for them to just have a space that fits the scope of this event. You know, New York, it's the best city in the world, and you have Comic-Con, which is your biggest meeting of pop culture. You know, you gotta have a blowout venue for that. So.
Yeah. Would you ever consider maybe going into the realm of cartoons someday? I mean, I know that you mentioned that you're doing stuff with Nickelodeon for their Nickelodeon magazine. Is that one of the things that's quite possibly in your pipeline for maybe a couple of years from now?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've, for probably about the last year or so, been sporadically developing what I would like to see eventually become an animated series. And it's not so much on the front burner that I have a goal date or anything like that set for it. I am still really working hard to build up the comic in newspapers and certainly, you know, have to look at how much time I have to commit to that. But I do hope, you know, cross my fingers, in the next 2-3 years, I would at least like to, if anything, do a short flash pilot for, you know, a pop culture shock therapy based series and get that out and see if people like it, have interest in it. Again, it's definitely a secondary priority at this point, but I think a lot of the humor lends itself to animation. There are times where I'll have an idea and it just won't work, you know, in the constraints of a panel. And there's also humor in voice and music and inflections, that things that don't translate necessarily well in a single panel comic, that, you know, I'd love to delve into those realms of pop culture, but, you know, find that it doesn't always fit in this venue.
Yeah.
So that's the long answer, that yes, I'm hoping to. It'll be some time before you see that.
Yeah. Different, similar question, different medium. How about a straight comic book someday? Because I know that you mentioned that you were a comic fan when you were a kid. Have you ever considered maybe putting out a comic book, as it were?
You know, it's interesting. I toyed around with what's the best way to get the work out in print and collections. And so far, the first couple of years I've gone with the compilation books. I have started exploring the possibility of collecting a couple of months at a time and putting them out in a comic book form. So not so much as redoing my work in a narrative form, but reprinting the individual panels in a more comic book form. There's some real pluses and minuses to that, so I'm still trying to figure out if that would fly or not. I think one of the real pluses is that I think your average comic book reader is drastically more pop culture literate and savvy than just kind of the general populace. So putting the work in that format gets it immediately into the comic stores and into the hands of a much better target audience for me. On the flip side, I also understand that your average comic book reader, the majority of them do tend to put their money into superhero comics. Clearly, humor panel is something very different. So I don't know how that would fly. I don't know if someone who, you know, spends $3 on a Superman or a Batman comic, if they would spend $3 on a collection of, you know, pop culture gag panels. So, you know, there's research to be done there. It's certainly another possible venue, but it's one that I realize could put a lot of time and financial resources into and bomb. So I'm not jumping into that haphazardly, but it is something that I've looked at and am considering and continuing to explore.
Well, comic books can be a cruel mistress sometimes, because I mean there have been plenty of comics out there that I myself have read that for me were some of the best humor comics that I've read. You know, very satirical, very, even if they were superhero comics, that have a bit of a satire to them that just quite possibly just did not get the press that they needed to continue, and because of that ended up canceled before their time. So I mean, I hate to see that happen, but it does happen.
Yeah, and I think especially when you're independently publishing, that becomes even, you know, a bigger concern because of, you know, you're using your own resources for it. I think you're right. I think there's great work out there. You know, some of my favorite comic books didn't fit into the traditional superhero genre. I was a huge ElfQuest fan growing up, and into the original Mage series, which was produced by Kamiko or Comico. I never figured out how they pronounced it, but you know, so there's definitely there are ways to get less traditional works out there, and obviously like Love and Rockets and, you know, Lone Wolf and Cub. There have been a lot of successful creators with work that aren't in the superhero genre. However, there are so many more that have tried and not been able to crack the market. So it's certainly you know, it's a risk and, you know, one that needs to be weighed before I jumped into it.
Yeah, definitely. Now, what sort of advice would you give for an up-and-coming comic artist that might be looking at putting their work on the internet?
You know, it's hard for me to kind of give broad advice to anybody in any art medium because I don't have experience, certainly in some of the more, you know, the like the animation field.
Sure.
Or in you know, in comic books, but certainly speaking from doing a comic panel, I would highly encourage anybody who wants to get into this field to start out with the internet. I think that, you know, it's a really good way to jump in the water and see if you can swim. You know, if you find that you can't, you know, whether you're doing it even daily or as a weekly, even if you just want to do a weekly comic, if you find you're having a hard time meeting the deadlines, you know, it might tell you you need to take a step back, because most, even syndicated cartoonists who have large companies out there backing and selling their work, vast majority of them, because syndicates operate on a 50-50 split with the creator, it takes several years usually before the average creator can quit their quote-unquote day job, or at least, you know, modify their work schedule to fit that better. So, you know, it certainly is something that you need to see if doing, you know, putting whatever time you have to into whatever else it is that's, you know, making your income before you're making a decent income off of it. You know, you have to find out, can you give that time? And I also think it really is a great way to build an audience, to build up a body of work, to build your reputation, also to develop your art style. Your work, when you consistently draw or write on a daily basis, or do so almost every day, you know, over the course of a year or two, you're going to better develop your own personal style. And I think that having your work out there for people to look at and to tell you they love it or they hate it and slam it or write you great things about it, it's a great motivator to put out good work, and that really helps you develop that quality. So I highly recommend the internet. I mean, for really established, rich, syndicated cartoonists, I think the internet is somewhat of a nightmare to them because it's a way that they're used to getting money for their work, and all of a sudden they're going from getting money to people getting it for free.
Yeah.
I think the other way around, it is a huge, huge resource, and I would encourage people to use it. And I will say this, I've heard of web cartoonists who have found ways, you know, when they build up interest in their site and they build up a readership, you know, they'll start selling T-shirts and, you know, other sort of paraphernalia that's, you know, either affiliated with their comic or not, and it just fits their target audience. You know, there is a lot to be said for drawing interest to your website and then using that as a financial resource to support yourself and your work.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know one, for example, Questionable Content, one of my favorite ones that I read regularly, started off as, you know, a guy who was basically just, you know, doing it on the side while doing his day job, and eventually it got to the point where he was able to quit his day job. You know, he's selling T-shirts now. He's basically, you know,
yep,
making all of his money through the website. And, well, hey, you know, if you can get to that point, that's fine, but you got to start somewhere, and the internet's a great place to do it.
Exactly. I think a lot of times, and I'll certainly throw myself into this category, I think a lot of times when people think they want to be something but haven't actually gone through the process of it, they fall in love with the romanticized version of what they think that is. Oh, I want to be a movie star. Oh, I want to be, you know, a rock star. Oh, I want to be a singer. Oh, I want to draw comic books. Oh, whatever. You know, sometimes people think about, oh, it would be cool to be that, but they don't think about, you know, the time and the energy and the rejection and the work that it takes. And really, that's the starting point. You know, you have to start with, hey, no one knows who I am, no one knows my work, and I just need to do it for myself and because I love to do it. You know, anything that you romanticize and you think, oh, this would be great, I'd love to be a musician, I'd love to be a cartoonist, if you're not doing it on a day-to-day basis, you really don't know if you're going to love it, and you might find that you don't. And if you find that you don't, that's okay. It's not bad to change, you know, what your dreams are and your interests are, but certainly the way you find out if you're going to love being a cartoonist or, you know, a radio talk show host or whatever, you can't do it, and you can't find that out until you do it through experience. And the internet certainly provides that opportunity.
Definitely, without a doubt. Now, looking at your bio here, did you really live in communist Poland?
I did, actually. You know, it's funny. My bio is, obviously, as a cartoonist, I try and put some funny things in my bio. And by the way, on my new book, I have a new, different bio that I think has some good, funny stuff in. So you can check that out. But the old bio I have on my website, and I have to apologize for anybody that goes to it. We put the bio up when I first started the comic. It is really out of date. The only good thing about it is, for whatever reason, not thinking to the future of doing this, I put that I was a 29-year-old cartoonist. Well, that's great. When you're now a 30-something-year-old cartoonist and you look back, you're, yay, that's great. I'm perpetually 29.
There you go.
So, anyway, sorry, off topic, but, yeah, I actually did live in Poland in the late 1970s. My father is in religious ministry and at that time was getting his master's in theology and did his master's thesis. You know, I'm going to butcher it, but it was something about like studying the Bible in certain ways with priests and in a communist environment. Whatever it was, it involved our whole family moving and living in Poland when it was behind the Iron Curtain. And I was very young, but do have some definitely interesting memories from that time.
That must have been one hell of a change, you know, going from from here to communist Poland, all of a sudden living some of your life in there.
You know, the funny thing was, I think the shell shock was more coming back. Again, I was like, you know, 5 years old, so I have limited memories of it, but my parents tell us that when we came back, when we lived there, we were on a tourist visa because you couldn't, you know, just go in and move into a communist country. So we go in a couple of months and then, you know, go out of the country into another European country that wasn't communist and renew our visa and go back. And it was kind of this constant bouncing back and forth. Well, for countries in Eastern Europe that were behind the Iron Curtain at that time, you would go through very strict border checks. And, you know, from country to country, you'd be stopped at these checks with armed guards. They'd search your car for 3 hours and, you know, check your papers and all that. When we came back to the United States, my parents said when we would drive cross country to go see our grandparents, my brother and I would always be like, hey, how come we're not, you know, at every state line, we're not stopping and the armed guards aren't coming and searching our car, you know?
So
definitely culture shock.
Hey, well, you know, you get to tell people now also, you know, I worked with Joe Kubert when I was 10 years old, and I lived in communist Poland. I've lived one hell of a life.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some interesting stories. It might make a boring book, but certainly some fun anecdotes. I did a radio interview just a week or so ago, and the person interviewing me who had read my bio asked if I like Coke or Pepsi better. I told them I like Coke, and they said, oh, well, is that the inner communist in you, liking the red can? And I was like, wow, that's some... You know, that's something for the therapist.
Oh, man. Well, do you still eat a bowl of Lucky Charms every morning? That's the question.
No. Yeah, my eating habits have improved drastically. I will say I have always been a huge Lucky Charms fan. You know, the older you get, you'll find the more health conscious you need to become. Wow, my voice just cracked. That was weird. For everyone out there to hear, but now my breakfast usually consists of oatmeal.
Well,
not quite as fun.
Oh, man. Well, you know, it works in the bio. That's what matters.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I'll leave that up forever.
Definitely. So. if I remember correctly, you did at least one or two with the Lucky Charms leprechaun, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, actually, I really like Lucky the Leprechaun. You know, I don't traditionally think of him as an easy character to come up with things around, but some of my personal favorites have involved him. So, you know, he's in my brain somewhere from eating those Lucky Charms.
Well, that leads me to one of my final questions, actually. What are some of your favorite comics that you've done?
Let's see. That's tough. And the reason it's a tough question to ask is because I do my comics in monthly batches, basically in 4-week
okay.
batches, 24 comics at a time. So each time I do a new batch, sometimes there are ones that I get really into that then, you know, the test of time, I might not like so much down the road. I will say that a couple that stand out to me, one of my favorites is from a long time ago. I did a Sir Mix-a-Lot in high school English, and he's sitting there. He's had his paperback, and I got to apologize to your listeners because comics are meant to be read, not to be cited. So this might sound horrible, and if it does, then just forget it and read the book, and you might see what's funny in it. But he essentially gets his paperback, and it's, you know, what he's written is my anaconda don't want none unless you've got bun ton, and it's been corrected by his teacher, and it's my anaconda doesn't want any unless you have buns, honey, and you know it's certainly more visual. You know, that's one of my favorites. You know, there are a couple others I won't kill you with describing, but most of my favorites are in the first and the second book. Basically, so far I've done somewhere I counted recently between 1,100 and 1,200 comics,
wow.
And between the first two books, there's less than 400. So. You know, they're most of the ones that I really liked or that I got feedback from readers that they really liked. So any of those you'll find. Also, I just finished up. I had an exhibit of my original work in Manhattan at a gallery there. And that was really fun to pick comics out for because it was different. I was picking out ones that were my favorites that I liked, but I was also trying to pick them out from a visual medium. There are certainly comics that are, you know, funny, but maybe the artwork isn't, you know, it might just be a couple of people talking and it's the gag that's funny or what they're saying is funny. The interesting thing about picking the exhibit, I had to pick out about 30 to 40 pieces that I thought were funny, but also that the visually would be interesting for people to look at. And one that stands out in my mind from that, I had a comic that the caption was Jim Henson's Psycho, and you see Ernie in the bathtub singing his Rubber Ducky, You're the One song to his Rubber Ducky, and kind of in the background is the shadow of Bert behind the curtain, you know, with the knife poised, like a la Psycho, ready to go after him. Again, you know, it's a lot more visual, but, you know, that's another one that stands out to me. There are certain characters, I would say, that I find very easy to write comics about, and because of that, I do often use. And for whatever reason, Hannibal Lecter is just one. I think there's just something funny about someone walking around in normal daily life who is a cannibal. And, you know, and some of the natural humor that comes out of that, it's, you know, I find that I do a lot around Hannibal Lecter from Silence of the Lambs. Also Superman, I think because of the fact that he's, you know, basically all powerful and is, you know, somewhat a godlike figure. You know, the more powers and abilities and things that someone can do, well, the more there is to poke fun of or to use in poking fun of other things. So Superman ends up popping in a lot. And, you know, then there are certain just like, you know, like I was always growing up huge Star Wars fan, so Star Wars, and there are certainly a lot of recognized characters in popular culture through the Star Wars movie. So Star Wars pops up, you know, pretty frequently, and Disney characters always. I would say there's probably not a month goes by where I don't, you know, either kill a Disney character or, you know, have a Disney character doing something that no Disney character would ever be caught dead doing. And I think that's where Disney characters become an easy target, because there's so many, they're so entrenched in our imaginations. And, you know, it's kind of funny to see your Disney character with sitting there with the people they want to kill list, or, you know, something along those lines. So Disney gets their fair share of time in pop culture shock therapy.
Mickey Mouse, watch out, because Doug Bratton has your number. Oh, man. Are there any genres of pop culture that you yourself wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, or is anything up to the imagination?
You know, that's actually a really good question. There's one area, actually, an area that I don't touch, but it's more because of my ignorance of it, is the video gaming industry. It's frustrating to me because I know it is a huge part of popular culture. I've just never been, and just find I don't have time to get sucked into the world of video gaming. And I guess for the fear of appearing totally ignorant, I tend to stay away from references that, you know, it's going to look like I'm just taking something and throwing it in for the sake of a gag. You know, I usually try and, whatever gag I'm doing, I try and have the character somehow tie into it in a way that works for that character or that movie or whatever. So video games, every once in a while you might see like a classic video game touched on, but, you know, I tend to stay away from that. And again, it's just because of my own ignorance. I tread a little bit cautiously with religious figures. You know, it's a pretty, for people who haven't read it, if you read it, it's a pretty irreverent comic. You know, I certainly follow the guidelines of, you know, not depicting graphic sex or, you know, graphic violence or nudity or things that would keep me from being in a newspaper. But at the same time, I certainly think I push the envelope for your standard for newspaper comic. I think because of that, religious characters, you know, I every once in a while I'll do one if I think that I can get away with it. I tend to actually write a lot that involve Jesus, but don't tend to use them very much because, one, I don't want to offend, you know, whatever percentage of the population. And certainly the ones that I write aren't making fun of, you know, of Jesus. You know, I tend to try not to make fun of individual religious figures. But even going to the Superman reference, any character or individual who has a broad knowledge base in the culture and has been attributed being able to do, you know, great things or have different powers. There's just a lot to hit on. Most of those end up staying in my sketchbook, and a couple years from now, I'm probably going to put out a 5-year kind of retrospect, and I'll probably put some of those that I kind of self-censored in there. I do, around Christmas, I'll usually throw in a comic with Jesus in it, but it's more poking fun of Jesus having to share his birthday with Christmas. And the reason that I do that is, one, I think that, you know what, obviously there are going to be some people that are offended by anything, and you know what, if they are, sorry, not much I can do about it. But I actually, my birthday is Christmas Day, and to me, you know, you write from your life experience and you find humor in aspects of what you find funny in your life. Well, sharing your birthday with Christmas, for anybody out there who's done it, is a very unique, odd experience, because you grow up and everybody in the world gets presents on your birthday. You know, everybody in the world gets more presents on your birthday than you typically would get on
That's
your
awesome.
Birthday. So, you know, there are funny things that tie into that. So I like to, it's certainly not poking fun of, you know, Jesus as a religious figure, but I like to each year kind of work in some way of poking fun of having to share your birthday with Christmas, and what better way to do that than the reason that, you know, that Christmas is celebrated.
Yeah, and I mean, no matter what you do, there's going to be at least one person out there who gets offended. But you know what? That's because everybody has their own opinions on everything.
It's funny. I very early on fought with, you know, how much do I stay away from certain taboo subjects? And, I made a decision very early on that there was nothing that I wouldn't touch on as long as I felt knowledgeable about it and that I wasn't, you know, trying to specifically offend a certain group of people. So, you know, for example, I'll do comics that are, you know, related to hip hop culture, and I'm not doing it to make fun of hip hop culture. I'm satirizing something that's part of our popular culture, just like I would anything else. So it's, you know, it's certainly not meant to offend anyone who, you know, is into hip-hop culture, just like I'm not trying to offend people that are into Disney, or I'm not trying to offend, you know, someone who is Christian when I do a comic that, you know, what ties into Christmas or Jesus. Just like, you know, if I do a Hanukkah comic, or I do, I have a comic with Mother Teresa or Gandhi, you know, I pretty much, you know, if whatever it is out there has become a part of the popular culture, I like to find a way to bring it into the comic. And, you know, I think that most people who read my work realize that I'm not making fun of any specific individual religious group or any specific racial or cultural or ethnic background, but anything that ties into those things that hits into popular culture, you're gonna, at some point, you'll see it in a Pop Culture Shock Therapy comic.
Well, that sounds good to me, and you certainly do a great job with it, and I want to certainly thank you for joining us today on Geek Speak. Doug, it's been a great pleasure.
Well, thanks a lot, Ian. I look forward to hearing the broadcast and checking it out, and hopefully I'll see you at Mocha in a couple
of
weeks.
You most certainly will. Now, what's your email address for anybody who feels like contacting you?
Sure. My email address is dbratton, and it's spelled B-R-A-T-T-O-N, at popculturecomics.com, and comics is spelled the regular C-O-M-I-C-S way. And that's my website, is just popculturecomics.com. And again, that's D as in Doug, which is my name, Bratton, B-R-A-T-T-O-N, at popculturecomics.com.
Well, certainly sounds good to me, man. And anybody who wants to email GeekSpeak, you can indeed at speakgeekspeak@gmail.com. That's speakgeekspeak@gmail.com. And don't forget to vote for us on Podcast Alley. The link will be in the show notes. And if you want to write up some iTunes reviews, I certainly would not be opposed to it. You can find that on iTunes. Just click on reviews, write what you think of the show, and let me know what you think. So another episode of Geek Speak is in the can. I'm Ian Levenstein for Doug Bratton. Have a great week. Enjoy your geek. Take care, everybody. And I will see you next week on Geek Speak.